Chapter 11. What We Can Do. Can there be any doubt that if the former Yugoslavia or Rwanda had been small countries nestled next to the United States, say immediately south of San Diego, then those countries' leaders would not have embarked upon their eliminationist politics, let alone their exterminationist programs? Would Slobodan Milosevic have tried to expel a million Kosovars into California, let alone slaughter 8,000 men, as he did in Srebrenica, in a city where Tijuana is today? Would he have set up concentration and rape camps and had roaming Serbian killing units within shouting distance of the American border, slaughtering men and raping women systematically in town after town? Would Teonesta Bagosora and the Hutu leadership have begun an attack to hack and club to death hundreds of thousands of people in full view of the American public and polity? To ask these questions is to answer them. No, Milosevic would not have dared. Bagosora and the Hutu leaders would not have dared. And had either done so, swift and massive American intervention would have ended the eliminationist assault, whatever its form. What does this thought experiment teach us? We can find out if we ask why, proximate to San Diego, no political leaders, no matter the circumstances, would initiate mass expulsions and exterminations. What factors would make such a solution to any problem unfeasible or unthinkable, even for political leaders wishing to adopt an eliminationist program and who, in other geographic settings and circumstances, would eagerly implement one? Slaughtering or expelling people by the hundreds of thousands in such a hypothetical North American country would be so unfeasible and unthinkable that we would not consider calling it prevention if a political leader, fearing intervention, would choose not to implement an eliminationist ideal. Because it would not be prevention in the narrow sense of taking action that forestalls an imminent assault, it is difficult for people to see that, in a broader sense, prevention is precisely what it would be. The topic of prevention must be rethought. Doing so requires embedding its analysis in a discussion of several other themes that have emerged from this investigation. Just as eliminationist assaults are predicated upon a preparatory eliminationist discourse, laying out the conceptions of problems and people putatively causing them, which provides the foundation for thinking that acting against those people is necessary and urgent, preventing such assaults requires an analogous, countervailing anti-eliminationist or pro-human discourse. This discourse has several components. An accurate recognition of the problem of exterminationist and eliminationist assaults and politics. An accurate understanding of the domestic and international failures producing our catastrophic state of affairs. And an agreement that we must urgently act to prevent future exterminationist and eliminationist assaults, including smaller ones, to send eliminationist politics on the road to extinction. This anti-eliminationist discourse must be structured around eliminationist politics' most fundamental facts. They have been a politics of impunity with the perpetrators' subjective benefits far outweighing the costs. Hence the frequency. Such an anti-eliminationist discourse prepares the way for redressing the catastrophic state of affairs. This also has several components. We must recognize that the possibility of effecting change in this large, difficult area, though unacknowledged, is real, practical, and achievable. We must establish it as right to do. We must create the necessary resolve to exercise our power for acting upon our duties, and we must devise the measures and policies that will effectively end eliminationist politics. In sum, we must reverse our times and human history's prevailing equation by ensuring two things. Eliminationist politics will no longer be a politics of impunity, and when political leaders examine the social and political landscape, they will know that initiating an exterminationist or eliminationist onslaught will incur for them enormously more costs than benefits. The need for a powerful anti-eliminationist discourse. Ordinary citizens and political and media elites alike must recognize eliminationist politics' extent and character. At any moment, the problem, though grave, can appear local when in truth it is of broad, even global, significance. A single snapshot often distorts the more general and systemic nature of political and social phenomena, including this one. From the start of the 20th century, our era's eliminations have, as we now know, produced death tolls of 127 million and perhaps as many as 175 million, or if China's and the Soviet Union's higher estimates are correct, still many more, far outnumbering war's military casualties. When we look more broadly to eliminationist campaigns, particularly including expulsions, the numbers are more shocking. The Soviets, in addition to killing on the order of 10 million people, expelled vast populations from their homes and eliminated through incarceration in the Gulag many millions more for long periods. The Indonesians slaughtered perhaps 500,000 communists and, by the regime's own admission, deposited three times as many, 1.5 million, in camps, often for years. As part of their eliminationist campaign against non-believing communists, they compelled non-affiliated Indonesians to adopt religion. In the wake of the mass slaughter, 2.8 million Indonesians in Java, Timor, and North Sumatra converted to Christianity or Islam. The Khmer Rouge killed 1.5 million and expelled and incarcerated in camps virtually the rest of the country's 8 million people. In Ethiopia, the Mengistu regime eliminated from the country's northern regions 6 to 8 times the 250,000 they slaughtered, upward of 2 million. The Guatemalan rightists killed perhaps 200,000 people, leftists and mainly Maya, and expelled 2.5 to 5 times more, 500,000 to 1 million Maya. Saddam Hussein, in addition to murdering 500,000 Kurds, Marsh people, Shia, and others, expelled many hundreds of thousands more from their homes and regions. Seeking to eradicate all non-Arabic characteristics from Iraq's Kirkuk region, Saddam also conducted a forced transformation campaign of unknown size, formally begun in 1997, compelling non-Arabic people, especially Kurds, Turkomans, and Assyrians, to renounce their ethnic identities and adopt an Arab one. The Serbian eliminationists and their Croatian opposite numbers in sum killed many tens of thousands and expelled many times that number, including, by the Serbs, 1.5 million Kosovars. As of 2009, political Islamists have slaughtered more than 400,000 Darfurians and have expelled perhaps 6 times that number, 2.5 million, after having killed 2 million and expelled more in southern Sudan. Even the Germans, who readily annihilated those designated for elimination, expelled millions from their homes and regions. The list goes on and on, including India and Pakistan during the partition, China, North Korea, the Pakistanis in Bangladesh, Burundi, Rwanda, and many more. The countries and peoples either perpetrating or suffering exterminationist and eliminationist campaigns span the globe and humanity. Billions of people have themselves been potential targets or have had relatives, friends, or members of their communities mass murdered or brutally expelled from their homes. It should not need to be said, but it does. Eliminationist politics and its most acute exterminationist variant is an urgent, first-order global problem. If next week perpetrators assaulted 1 or 5 people in your neighborhood or community solely because of their identity, brutalizing and expelling them from their homes and neighborhood, or butchering them in the street, you would treat it as a cataclysm. It would receive intensive media coverage, produce a communal and societal uproar, and engender an immediate political response. People and resources would insistently mobilize against this and future occurrences. Why should we respond politically to the same acts differently when the victim numbers multiply by 1,000 or 1 million just because the people are or have been or will be far from our homes? The problem of eliminationist politics should not be reduced to bromides. The problem is not human nature. Mass murder and eliminations are not inevitable or unavoidable. Transnational forces beyond human control do not cause them. We need not throw up our hands in hopeless despair. The problem is straightforward and political. Although difficult, it can and must be addressed politically with intellect, energy, institutional design, and resources. We must go beyond conventional thinking and practices. First, we must confront the facts, not romanticized fictions, not politicized and therefore obscured fictions, but the facts. Mass murder and eliminationist politics are humanity's human scourge, more devastating than natural disasters, more murderous and worse than war. They destroy the lives of so many more people, devastate survivors among families, scar communities for generations, immutably alter societies and polities. Yet on the nightly local news, mass murders receive far less attention, in absolute terms, than house fires. In relative terms, according to death toll and human suffering, the media underplay eliminationist slaughters and expulsions and incarcerations by 1,000 to 1,000,000 times. Western people's misplaced values direct more attention to the latest sensational murder case, be it celebrity-driven or not, than ongoing mass slaughters and eliminations in several countries. Take, in the United States, the media obsession and manufactured sensation in 2004, while I was drafting this part of the book, of Scott Peterson's murder of his pregnant wife, Lacey Peterson, and destruction of the baby she was carrying. For more than a year, newspapers, magazines, and especially television covered the unfolding events with the diligence and fascination due a presidential election. The crime, the hunt for the killer, the arrest of first name familiar Scott, the prosecution's and defense's preparations, and from gavel to gavel, the trial itself. Measured by the media coverage, one would have thought that, aside from the American war and occupation in Iraq and the presidential election itself between George W. Bush and John Kerry, Scott and Lacey's story was by far that year's most important political or legal event. Horrible as Scott's murder of his pregnant wife and son-to-be was, political Islamic Sudanese Arabs multiplied its horror hundreds of thousands of times with their contemporaneous mass expulsion and mass murder of Darfur's people. Yet that campaign received a tiny fraction of media coverage, attention, and discussion in absolute terms and in proportion to its significance. Multiply this comparative neglect by the number of other American murder cases turned into media sensations for millions of people's lurid viewing, and the neglect of the eliminationist assaults in Darfur, or those in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or Tibet, or Chechnya, or North Korea, and others, becomes that much more striking and morally reprehensible. I commit here the supposed sin of sounding preachy. The media must do more to create and sustain a robust anti-eliminationist discourse. They must convey to the public, including political and policy elites, the facts about mass murders and eliminations as they take place, and about the leaders masterminding them. For all their failures, the American media, much too late, finally did this in Bosnia, and thereby created pressure on the Clinton administration to act. Bosnia and Herzegovina's president Haris Salijic maintains that the media were critical. The media, the American media, helped a great deal. They helped us in getting this story out. Bosnia shows the media's immense power to spur action, which only highlights their deficiencies in almost every other eliminationist instance. When an eliminationist assault begins, or ideally before, the media must immediately and insistently convey that 1. The world community, as a community, faces urgent crises in one or several of its regions. 2. The world community can save the lives of hundreds, thousands, sometimes millions of people. And 3. Not to do so is to be complicit in the carnage. This is the media's duty, no less than they would certainly do all three if a criminal or terrorist band held 20 hostages barricaded in a government building in Washington, London, Berlin, Rome, Madrid, Paris, or Tokyo, or for that matter in rural or small-town America, Britain, Germany, Italy, Spain, France, or Japan. The media's failure to publicize individual mass murders and eliminations as they occur elsewhere is surpassed by their failure to convey the general problem of mass murder and elimination's immensity and character. The basic facts are virtually unknown, even to interested elites. Why? Broad discussion of mass murder and elimination's high frequency and colossal aggregate damage, and the international community's and political leaders' failure to take the easy measures not taken to prevent or stop them, might shame the world's peoples, or at least some of them. Scholars, media, and politicians alike would face the moral burden of confronting their own unwillingness to do what they ought to and easily could do. Help end these murders and assaults that dwarf all others. This media and political failure is not equivalent to the failure to publicize and analyze poverty and disease around the world, for the simple reason that no domestic or global consensus exists that all people have a right, certainly an enforceable right, to specified minimal living standards, or what those standards would be, or freedom from easily preventable diseases. The need for such a consensus is another topic. Yet an international consensus enshrined in international law mandates that all people have the right not to be tortured, eliminated through expulsions, or murdered. Slaughtering children is unanimously held to be an unambiguous and great crime. Indeed, these are among the few universal rights international law and the world's people commonly recognize and say it is a legal duty to stop. This norm not to slaughter people en masse, at least as a norm, is so powerful that even regimes routinely violating it formally recognize it. Discussing the facts about our time's mass murders and eliminationist politics is also unpopular in many countries because so many of us would have to critically examine ourselves and our forebears. Harry Truman was a mass murderer. He should be put in the dock no less than Stalin, Pol Pot, and the others. A barrage of vitriolic and dishonest criticism will likely meet these statements. Powerful constituencies, political, media, academic, and others, in every country having practiced eliminationist politics, pounce on those daring to speak politically explosive or discomforting truths. This leads to those positioned to disseminate the facts censoring themselves. After the publication of Hitler's Willing Executioners, one European country's former prime minister told me that even though he and, as he put it, everyone in his country knew my book about ordinary Germans' anti-Semitically grounded willingness during the Nazi period to kill Jews is correct, had prospective publishers of the book prior to publication asked, he would have urged them not to publish it because he would have feared, wrongly, he then conceded, that its truths would harm the image of today's Germany and Germans among his countrymen and worsen relations with Germany. Some prominent Jews told me not to address certain pressing issues in A Moral Reckoning, my book on the Catholic Church's need to perform repair after the Holocaust, not because I was wrong, but because speaking the truth about the Church's practices and tenets might encourage the Church to criticize those of Jews. Attacks on and intimidation of people speaking the truth about eliminationist assaults come mainly from those feeling afflicted by the facts or from their surrogates. Those wanting truths to remain buried about Germans and the Catholic Church respectively, with German politicians, high church officials, and their politicized allies in the academy leading the way, dishonestly and vociferously attacked my books and me. In 2005, Orhan Pamuk, the soon-to-be Nobel Prize-winning novelist, was subjected to kindred attacks and even indicted in Turkey. Immense international pressure eventually led to the charges being dropped, for acknowledging the Turks' genocide of the Armenians. This was part of the Turkish government's and much of its society's intimidation and disinformation campaign to have the world accept the fiction that it never happened. Similarly, Japanese rightists have unremittingly attacked and threatened violence against the Japanese Nobel Prize-winning novelist Kenzaburo Oe for telling the truth about the Japanese eliminationist assault on Okinawans at the end of World War II. In 2005, a Japanese court allowed a rightist-supported suit seeking to suppress his book, Okinawa Notes, about the forced mass suicides. The Japanese government, under the nationalist Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, a systematic denier of Japanese mass murders and eliminations, used the lawsuit as one of several pretexts to try to rewrite Japanese school textbooks to cover up Japanese lethal coercion against Okinawans. This led to Okinawans' massive protest. Oe spent 2.5 years successfully defending the lawsuit. The formal and often well-organized deniers of discomfiting or inconvenient historical truths, such as Holocaust deniers, exist in virtually all countries whose people have perpetrated eliminationist onslaughts. Governments or powerful institutions and groups usually undertake extensive disinformation campaigns to confuse publics, intimidate those wanting to tell the truth, and forestall necessary measures of prevention, intervention, and repair. Turkey is but the best-known current example of prosecuting or intimidating those speaking such historical truths. A Turkish diplomat in the United States once said privately that his two main tasks were maintaining the American foreign aid level and keeping the Armenian question off the table. Turkey's genocide denial has become so contentious that the European Union has made Turkey's admission of the genocide a membership condition. In 2007, when the U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Relations Committee passed a non-binding resolution that was never likely to pass the full House, acknowledging the genocide, Turkey recalled its ambassador and threatened non-cooperation in the Iraq War. Many German politicians and groups, though acknowledging most of the Holocaust's basic facts, for years tried to suppress the truth about ordinary Germans' willing role in perpetrating the Holocaust, blaming instead abstract structures or faceless Nazis, to which, in the post-war fairy tales, few Germans belonged. The Catholic Church, and for that matter, many European countries' governments and peoples, have long remained silent about or stridently denied their participation in the Jews' eliminationist and exterminationist persecution, though in the past decade some have tried to correct the historical record. After Stalin's death and the Gulag was dismantled, the Soviet Union proscribed speaking the truth about the mass murdering, and in Russia today many in and out of government still oppose it. Croats and Serbs each suppress the truth about their respective mass murders and eliminations against each other and others during the post-Yugoslavia recent past and the World War II era more distant past. In Japan, the government and powerful groups systematically deny the Japanese's mass murdering and eliminationist practices immediately before and during World War II, including the mass murdering in Nanking and elsewhere in Asia, and the systematic raping of Korean and other women and their enslavement as prostitutes, still referred to by the Times euphemism of comfort women. A decade after the Hutus' slaughter of the Tutsis, a movement to deny the genocide has developed, sadly including some French officials seeking to defend France's honor by denying the deeds the French government abetted. It goes without saying, but nevertheless deserves emphasis, that during mass eliminations and while the perpetrators remain in power potentially to kill again, they and their supporters, and those not wanting to bring them to justice or remove them, cover up, disinform, and most of all, practice silence. Such an example, likely unpopular to discuss in my usual circles, occurred recently. Publicizing the facts about eliminationist politics and assaults requires that media and politicians not only discuss them more frequently, but also change how they do so. They know that the language they use and how they frame issues is powerful and persuasive, so let them use it in the service of the victims and potential victims. They do not hesitate to refer to serial killers, murderers of 10 or 20 people, as serial killers or even mass murderers. But for the mass murderers of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people, the media and politicians avoid similar linguistic accuracy and moral rectitude. They do not call the political leaders initiating, organizing, and overseeing such slaughters, or their followers doing the dirty work, mass murderers. Think of how different, at home and abroad, the public's conception would be of Stalin or Mao or even of Hitler, about whom the truth is regularly told, if we routinely referred to them as the mass murderer Stalin, the mass murderer Mao, and the mass murderer Hitler. Consider how different the view of Indonesian leader Haji Muhammad Suharto, Hafez al-Assad of Syria, Fernando Romeo Lucas Garcia and Jose Efron Rios Montt of Guatemala, Milosevic of Serbia, Franjo Tudjman of Croatia, Saddam in Iraq, or Omar Hassan Ahmad al-Bashir in Sudan would have been during their rule had we reflexively called them, instead of President Suharto, the Indonesian mass murderer Suharto. Instead of President Assad, the Syrian mass murderer Assad. Instead of Presidents Lucas Garcia and Rios Montt, the Guatemalan mass murderers Lucas Garcia and Rios Montt. Instead of President Milosevic, the Serbian mass murderer Milosevic. Instead of President Tudjman, the Croatian mass murderer Tudjman. Instead of the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, the mass murderer Saddam Hussein. Instead of President al-Bashir, the Sudanese mass murderer al-Bashir. How much harder it would be for anyone abroad, foreign leaders, media, ordinary citizens, to pretend these butchers were legitimate leaders representing their people's interests, fit to be supported or dealt with as anything but colossal criminals and menaces to humanity. With the information power of the internet and satellite television, local elites and peoples who might not otherwise know would see how the world regards their murderous leaders of yesterday and today, and get a preview for thinking about tomorrow's prospective mass murderers. Some, though certainly not all leaders and their inner circles, may be deterred from acting on their eliminationist ideals if they know that mass murderer is all but guaranteed to forever be a prefix to their names. Some leaders of countries, including those of democracies, might be deterred from aiding and abetting other regimes' eliminationist onslaughts. Several American presidents have done this. If they too would be forever tagged with mass murdering accomplices or complicit in mass murder. A new, more accurate, more powerful anti-eliminationist and pro-human discourse about mass murder and eliminations must develop. The language we use to describe eliminationist onslaughts should be descriptively accurate. We should avoid euphemisms and obfuscating locutions such as ethnic cleansing. We should call perpetrators committing mass murder, mass murderers. We should use genocide, though analytically imprecise and therefore employed here sparingly, regularly and liberally for mass murders. It is codified in international law as the term to apply to large-scale mass murder, and it, more than any other term, conveys the magnitude of the horror of what perpetrators do to their victims. We should apply the term genocide to eliminationist programs that combine mass murder with expulsion, even when the perpetrators expel many more than they kill, as the Serbs did to the Kosovars. Of course, we should always specify as accurately as possible the size and mix of large-scale killings, expulsions, and incarcerations in camps, and the perpetrators' other brutalities, and the targets' identities. When the Hutus began mass murdering the Tutsis, the Clinton administration, European governments, African governments, and the United Nations knew almost instantaneously from their diplomats, the UN peacekeepers on the ground, and news reports what the Hutu were doing. All of them should have immediately and unequivocally told their peoples and the world that the Hutus were committing genocide. The genocides in the former Yugoslavia should have at once been denounced for what they were, genocide, and the mass murderer Milosevic as a genocidal killer, rather than whitewashed into ethnic cleansing. The burden of proof should have been shifted immediately to Milosevic and the Serbs to demonstrate that they were not perpetrating genocide. Such dissimulation and failure to speak the truth continues today. The United Nations, the political organization most responsible and best positioned to speak and act authoritatively against genocide, is the most glaring offender. But this comes as no surprise for an organization that was complicit in the Rwandan annihilation and silent and inactive as it watched Saddam's various eliminationist onslaughts unfold. When the United Nations issued its misleading Darfur report in January 2005, denying that the Sudanese government was committing genocide, genocidal intent appears to be missing, tepidly deeming it a mere situation of violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law, governments and media around the world should have immediately denounced the report for what it really was: genocide denial more devastating than Holocaust denial, because it was whitewashing, minimizing, denying an ongoing genocide. They should have insisted the political Islamic Sudanese government's mass annihilation and expulsion of Darfurians be called genocide. Nothing less. Political leaders and the media analyzing mass murder and eliminations should avoid four frequent pitfalls: the language of equivalence, primordial hatred, human nature, and abstract structures. The language of equivalence, explaining mass violence and killing and expulsions as resulting from ethnic conflict, is the frequent practice. It suggests that competition for which two parties are responsible produces these deeds. It also suggests that the putative ethnic conflict at issue has somehow spun out of control, as ethnic conflict is allegedly wont to do, that somehow mass murder just happened as a consequence of an escalating process. This misrepresents how mass murders and eliminations begin. The second pitfall, the language of primordial hatred, suggests inevitability that this, as we now know, is precisely the opposite of mass elimination's initiation and execution. If mass murder is presented as the outcome of primordial hatred, then it seems beyond rationality and impervious to rational policy initiatives. The third problem, the unarticulated frame for or variously finding its way into reporting of genocides, is to write them off to human nature, an adult or juvenile variant of boys will be boys, or to the lamentable notion that certain countries, regimes, or peoples are primitive and cannot be held to civilized standards. All these and other depictions, such as treating killing and brutalities as war's unfortunate or unavoidable byproduct, or the expression of the unbearable distress of poverty, colonial injustice, or globalization, makes annihilationist assaults seem natural and, in some sense, inevitable, or propelled forward by larger, intractable forces, and therefore also unpreventable and unstoppable. These notions, whether explicit or implicit, disserve all political leaders and public alike who want mass murder and elimination to end. The fourth problem, a corollary of the first three, is the failure to discuss the real causes of genocide, in general and in individual instances, and specifically to name the people responsible. These pitfalls, to a greater or lesser degree, are to be found in U.S. President Bill Clinton's cynical justification for standing by idly as the Serbs continued their systematic eliminationist assault on Bosnians. Until these folks get tired of killing each other, bad things will continue to happen. The media, by being specific and accurate, can convey to elites and broader publics alike the genocide's reality that, before the world community's eyes, with every passing day, week, and month, human beings are choosing to slaughter hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, and to brutalize still many more. The media can provide a realistic account of the horror's causes, helping people to understand the most critical facts, that we can, as a practical matter, stop eliminationist onslaughts before they start or once they are underway. Even if the media do not explicitly urge governments and people to act, which they should, they would implicitly do so by making the moral questions unavoidable merely through straightforward reporting of the facts. Political leaders initiate mass murders and eliminations as rational political calculations to achieve political ends, even when based on fantastical notions about the victims. If the media make this clear, they will also convey to everyone that the issue is one of evil and good, not some vague notion of evil, but concrete evil embodied in the men setting out with full faculties to willfully destroy other human beings. These men, like Hitler and those serving him, can and therefore must be stopped. Lay out the facts. Lay out the causes. Lay out the often low-cost solutions, detailed momentarily, in language that is precise, vivid, and individuated. The perpetrators and the victims should not be treated as abstractions. We should eschew or not use as standalone terms such as Hutu extremists, earlier in Germany, the SS, in Bosnia, Arkan's tigers, or in Darfur, tribesmen. In general, we should not use terms such as extremists and radicals for the perpetrators because they automatically and usually wrongly suggest that conventional political means cannot persuade or stop the perpetrators. Instead, we should regularly refer to them more descriptively accurately as, for example, Turkish, German, Hutu, Serbian, or Sudanese perpetrators, or Turkish, German, Hutu, Serbian, or Sudanese killers, or Turkish, German, Hutu, Serbian, or Sudanese executioners, or even executors of their governments' or leaders' genocidal policies. We should personalize victims as much as possible, posing the question to the viewing publics, what would you want done? What would you want your government to do? What would you want the international community to do if the perpetrators were doing this to the family next door, or to the boys and girls living down the street? If the media simply reported and described exterminationist and eliminationist assaults accurately while they take place, many more people would support and even press their political leaders to stop shirking their duty. Terms such as mass murderer and genocide should be readily used while eliminationist assaults take place. The usual practice of prefixing alleged before mass murder or genocide, or the name of political leaders or military men responsible for them, only obfuscates what is clearly happening. We do not say the alleged war or alleged war initiator to describe a war or the dictator starting it. We must shift the burden of proof in the court of public opinion and require the prima facie guilty to demonstrate their innocence. After all, the world's media and publics are engaged not in legal proceedings, but in an attempt to shed light on catastrophic eliminationist assaults so they can be stopped. Many in the media say they want the world to learn of such horrors so that governments will act to end them. Let the media alter its reporting to facilitate these goals. This also means the media should tell publics that international institutions and the world's state system currently are ill-equipped to end mass murders and eliminations, and eliminationist politics more generally. Indeed, the international system's institutions are constituted, in part quite purposely, so they will not and cannot effectively halt eliminationist politics. exposing the incompetence, negligence, and complicity of international institutions, especially the United Nations, will wrest people from complacency, from assuming reflexively, as many do, that letting existing international institutions and international law operate according to their normal codes and procedures is best. Not surprisingly, many people look to the United Nations for guidance and to coordinate its member states against mass murder and eliminationist politics. This has been, and continues to be, hopelessly misguided. As the earlier discussion of the Genocide Convention shows, and as I discuss further in a moment, the United Nations has not been a force against mass murder and elimination, but their enabler. It has promoted an effective do-nothing approach to ongoing eliminationist assaults. As the hegemonic institution of the international system, it also prevents an alternative regime or organization from emerging with the structure, charter, membership, and politics to effectively combat and prevent, or at least greatly reduce the toll of, eliminationist politics. People need to see that only by fundamentally changing international institutions and by pressing them and governments to act in ways they ordinarily do not will stopping exterminationist politics be possible. Beyond descriptive and analytical accuracy, we must adopt the language of moral responsibility and a realistic, defensible notion of judgment based on what actually moves people to kill. Although political leaders and a society's fringe elements are deemed capable of having criminal, mass murderous intentions, ordinary people lending themselves to exterminationist and eliminationist assaults instead are reflexively seen by many either as duped, or in the Germans' case, coerced, or dismissed as uncivilized, backward barbarians. In fact, as we now know, exceptions notwithstanding, ordinary people become perpetrators or supporters of mass murder and eliminations out of conviction. Their beliefs about the putative, noxious, or threatening nature of and hatred for the victims lead them to think eliminating them to be right. So they brutalize, expel, and kill them willingly. How they come to these beliefs and emotions does not alter the basic facts about their mindset at the moment they kill or expel or otherwise eliminate their victims. They hate or coolly decide that mass murder or another form of elimination is morally correct or politically necessary. They may know that others, especially outside their countries, see it as wrong, yet they choose to kill and brutalize anyway. The problem of moral responsibility when a perpetrator believes such destructive politics is justified remains real no matter how he comes to hate, so long as he acts willingly. We have no difficulty judging and condemning political leaders for masterminding and setting into motion eliminationist onslaughts. We can judge and condemn individual perpetrators, such as a Serb on trial before the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague, or Timothy McVeigh for blowing up the federal building in Oklahoma City and slaughtering 168 people, including 19 children, and injuring another 850. But people have difficulty coming to the same conclusions for large numbers of ordinary Germans, Serbs, Hutus, and others. The vast number of the perpetrators, or their ordinariness, not having previously been members of radical political organizations, blunt judgment's normal processes. Is it because we have difficulty in thinking of the perpetrators as anything but a mass, or have been misled into seeing them in this dehumanizing way? Or is it because it is too disturbing or threatening to think of ordinary people, perhaps otherwise seeming like you or me, willingly perpetrating such horrors? Or is it because the problem of genocide is too daunting, the horror too overwhelming, and so we ignore or redefine it falsely to manage it psychologically and emotionally? Or are our moral faculties dulled by the encrusted and misleading ways scholars and media, politicians and jurists have dealt with such problems, focusing on the eliminationist leaders and ignoring or denying ordinary perpetrators' culpability, leading people to unthinkingly accept this false paradigm? People's systematic failure in judgment's exact causes are not clear, being likely variable, multiple, and overlapping. In any case, understanding those underlying causes matters less than acknowledging this systematic error. People, failing to maintain the individual perspective, reflexively opt for collective guilt and stereotypes about nationalities, or this debased moral coin's flip side, for absolving the perpetrators of responsibility, attributing full blame to leaders or structures or some other abstraction, blunting moral responsibility, and further clouding our view. Instead, we must maintain an individual-level perspective, recognizing that many ordinary people as individuals can and do act in concert to harm and kill other people on a colossal scale for the same or similar reasons that lead a single ordinary person to choose to harm or kill others. We must make it clear to publics around the world that almost no international prevention, intervention, or moral responses to the continuing succession of large and larger mass murders and eliminations exists. Internationally, eliminationist politics remains a politics of impunity. The problem is not that powerful countries, the United States, the European countries, and Japan, are too involved in foreign entanglements or adventures trying to save or prevent the ruin of millions of lives, though American engagements in Iraq and, with NATO, in Afghanistan may seem to suggest too much adventurism. The problem is they are too little involved and in wrong ways. Just as exterminationist and eliminationist politics are comprehensible and explicable, so are the possibilities for ending such politics. Elites and publics need to know explicitly that we, can effectively apply the brakes. Before exploring how to change the calculus of mass murder and eliminationist politics, we need to understand current institutional, legal, and policy affairs, particularly internationally, and how we arrived where we are. The historical developments have created certain structures, laws, and norms that powerfully impede states from acting to prevent or stop eliminationist assaults and to bring about necessary changes to the international environment.